In the mid-1980s, Congress put in place some of the toughest federal sentencing guidelines ever. If you were caught with crack cocaine, you were going away for a long time. Sean Hudson was one of the many young black men who stood and listened to those words from the bench.
When the judge, when he said 240 months, I'm trying to calculate that in my head, you know. And then when I finally got to the calculation, I'm like, wow, 20 years. And I was saying, you know, of course, okay, I broke the law, but people get out quicker than me that have killed people. I was like, okay, I got 20 years for what?
Sean Hudson is now out. He was released earlier this month because those sentencing guidelines have been revised. And while he's happy to be free, delighted to spend time with a daughter he barely knows, he's still bitter about the 15 years he did serve under crack laws that he says are racist laws. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Over the past 20 years, hundreds of thousands of young African-American men and women have gone to prison under the so-called crack laws. Most were given mandatory minimum sentences of 5, 10, or 20 years for the possession or distribution of crack cocaine. It was a policy that came from the Reagan administration's war on drugs. Well, last year the law was relaxed, and last month the first of the people held under the crack laws started to be set free. Sean Hudson was released earlier this month. Sean was arrested for dealing in St. Louis. He was given a 20-year sentence. He served 15.
The moment I stepped out of jail was a feeling that I couldn't describe, because I came in when I was 20 years old, so my mind matured while I was in prison. So, I mean, I came out at 35, so it was a great feeling.
What did you notice? What did you look at? What were you paying attention to?
Oh, everything. The trees, the grass, just about everything that my eye can come in contact with.
And what were you thinking?
First thing I was thinking was, wow, I can't believe that I'm actually getting out, because it's been so long. Finally, you know. The moment that I laid on the bed, a real bed, and was able to get up in the morning and open the ice box, I knew I was free then. Because, you know, in prison we got these little beds, bunk beds, and they're not that big and they're not that comfortable at all.
You were released in Atlanta and had to get back to St. Louis. How did you get home?
They gave me a bus ticket, and I caught the bus back to St. Louis.
How long would that trip be?
I'd say about 17 hours. But it wasn't that long to me, because, you know, it was the best ride I ever had. Cars, how the building structures have changed, how everything was just moving fast, you know. Everybody's trying to get somewhere.
Did you strike up any conversations with people on the bus?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Did you tell the people on the bus or the people that you talked to that you were just out of jail after 15 years in?
The person that I was sitting next to, I was telling them how glad I was to be free, you know.
Now, forgive me for asking this, Sean, but you were 15 years in jail from the age of pretty well 20 on through 35. Did you notice any women on the bus?
Oh, of course. They say you have a particular glow when you first get out. I was just looking all around to see what was going on and just to smell some perfume, because, you know, you're in prison with men 15 years. You know, if you smell perfume, you smell good. Everything from being in prison, you can smell foods and perfumes and all type of stuff real easy.
Tell me about getting home, though. Who was the person that you were, I guess probably your mother, you hadn't seen for a while?
Yeah, I hadn't seen my mom in a while. She was visiting me in prison, but as a matter of fact, she's the one that picked me up from the bus station. She, you know, had tears in her eyes, and, you know, I hugged her. And she's like, come on, let's get out of here. Yeah. So we left and got in the truck and drove home.
Now, was that the home that you lived in before you went to jail?
No. My mom's moved several times
since then. I would have figured
that,
yeah. So there was nothing familiar about that place, right?
No. Actually, I'm glad it's all new, because I want a new start, new ideas and everything. So actually, it's good that it's not the same place.
Sean says a lot has changed since the last time he was a free man, and it's taking him time to adjust.
I had to get back in tune with technology, because when I left the streets, they didn't have the internet. Everybody didn't have a cell phone. You know, cell phones were expensive then.
Yeah.
the toilets flush themselves. That was amazing.
you back away from the toilet and it flushes before you can get to it.
Yeah, I was like, wow, you know.
It's funny because you never think about those things as they go, but of course if you just, you know, disappear for 15 years, all that stuff is different. What else have you seen? What else catches your attention?
The people. Everybody looks fat and out of shape. Because I guess me being incarcerated, you know, because we work out all the time, and we don't have access to get hamburgers and all that stuff. You know, all the food, the fattening food.
Yeah.
So when I looked at everybody looked at overweight.
We're not looking too good, right? I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The last time Sean Hudson was on the street, he was dealing crack. He says it was an easy thing to fall into back in the early 90s. He grew up on the north side of St. Louis. He says drugs were all around, and so was the money.
You know, you can easily find yourself, if that's what you want to do, you can find yourself getting into some trouble. You can go find some trouble easy.
Is that what happened to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Things I was around.
Now, was your father living at home with you?
No. No. My mom raised me on her own.
And did she work to try and keep you out of trouble?
Oh, yeah. I had a great mom. She always made sure that I had the things I needed. And always talk to me about doing the right thing. But, you know, as a teenager, you don't listen. Well, I didn't listen. Some teenagers listen. I didn't listen. So I did what I wanted to do. You think you know everything when you're young, so got myself in trouble.
But there was a period of time, Sean, when you were holding down a proper job?
Oh, yeah. I worked for a while, and I made sure that I had the things I needed. But I found myself working just to pay bills, and I couldn't get the things that I wanted. I decided, I said, well, you know, why make $200 every 2 weeks when I can make $300 to $500 a day? And I'm not a mathematician, but that sounds better than every 2 weeks, wouldn't you say?
Hard to resist it when you're 16 or 17. Where were you working when you were
working?
Oh,
I worked McDonald's, several restaurants, Pofolk's, Shoney's. Yeah. I worked all type of restaurant jobs, you know.
And would you see other kids or other people your age who had more than you? Can you think of any one example like that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I remember going to school and I see the kids driving BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes. And, you know, I knew they didn't have a job. But, you know, their parents afforded them to get those type of things that they were driving. And, you know, I was like, hey, I want that too. But I didn't have the resources to get it the way they did. So I got it the best way I knew how to get it.
Do you remember the very first time that you sort of made the move into selling drugs?
Well, I was doing a maintenance job at the time.
Just mopping up the floor in McDonald's?
Mopping up the floor, et cetera, you know, putting meats up and just bought everything that they needed. And the person I knew, he'd come by and buy food all the time and in a nice car, and et cetera. And I'd be like, hey, you know, what's going on? You know, how can I get down? Those are the words we used.
What'd he say?
Well, he told me how I can actually get down. And he showed me. Told me what I need to do and showed me what I needed. I took it from there.
When you started out selling, how small time was it? What exactly would you do? I mean, what would you buy? What would you sell?
Well, you know, selling drugs is just like any other business, you know. Big corporations they have now, you know, you got to start off small. And starting off small would be actually selling street corner drugs. Mm-hmm. Because you're starting from the bottom. And as you advance, you start to get more drugs and you start to have more money. The more money you have, the more drugs that you were able to obtain.
What was it like when you started out?
I'll take $50 to $100 and buy $50 worth of cocaine or $100 worth of cocaine. And I'll take it and rock it up. And what I'll do is I'll cut the cocaine into different pieces. Like, say, if I take $50, I can take $50 and make $100 out of it. So the thing was to double your money, you know? So I'll take that and I'll maybe make $120. If I spend $100, I can make $200 or whatever, you know, $225 or whatever. So you always double your money when you were selling drugs, and that's what I was doing.
And if you're disciplined about this, if you're not spending your money or getting hooked on the drugs yourself, can you just keep making more and more? Are you, within a week, are you making like $1,000 or $2,000?
Oh, yeah, that's nothing. Because, you know, you got to realize the drug itself makes people want it more.
Yeah.
So after it's gone, you want another. And so if they buy more, then that means that I make more money.
And how much money were you making, Sean?
I was doing pretty well for myself. Started off as a street-level dealer, and I worked my way to be able to sell drugs to other drug dealers. And when I did that, then you made it to a certain level, and I lived comfortably, you know. I was able to do what I wanted to do without having to sweat.
Sean Hudson looks back at the time, though, when he started, because he started dealing on the street, and he says he was a little too cocky.
I got caught when I was 17 years old. Yeah, I'll never forget that. What happened was they had this undercover drug unit called a SCAT team. They'll send people posed as being drug addicts, right? Because, see, back then, you sell drugs on the street corners, and they'll walk up to you with $20 and ask to buy a piece of rock. Once you sell it to them, they'll walk away, and as you're walking away, the police apprehend you, and they'll take the money that they gave you, and they'll match it up, and then you'll get locked up. This is my first time ever being in trouble, and I got incarcerated. They put me in this place called the workhouse, like a county jail or whatever, and so I was waiting to go to court. And being that I didn't have any past history, and this was a state charge, I received probation for the drug sale, and I got 3 years papers with a 10-year backup, which is called a SIS sentence. And if I walk the paper down, which is the probation, then it gets off my record.
The whole thing's clear, yeah.
Exactly. And that's what happened when I was 17 years old.
Sean Hudson went back to his restaurant work, but as he recalls it, temptation got the better of him. He figured next time he'd just be smarter than the cops. He'd get off the street, he'd start supplying the dealers. He had no idea that the next time the police came knocking, it was going to cost him 20 years. Sean Hudson's life under the crack laws continues in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In the past 2 months, some 3,000 federal inmates have been given early release from prison. Most of them, African-American men who were locked up in the 80s and the 90s during the so-called War on Drugs. The harsh sentences that were mandatory back then have recently been reviewed, so many of the inmates are applying for early release, and many are getting it. Sean Hudson is one of them. Sean's a convicted crack dealer who got 20 years and served over 15 of those years before his release this month. He was telling me after his first arrest at age 17, it wasn't long before he was back into dealing.
Of course, I'm on probation. You know, I'm young. I go get my jobs and all of that. I'm working, trying to do what I need to do to get off this probation. But temptation got me again. So I'm thinking that I can get slick and try to make a couple moves. And that's what I started doing, making a couple moves. Because once you get away one time, you figure you can keep doing it. But I got caught that first time, so I figured, well, I know how to do this time. Instead of going around the right corner, I know how to go the other way to make sure I don't get caught, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the mentality I had as a 17-year-old.
When you think back to that time, what was it that you wanted? I mean, you saw other people with cars or clothes, or what was it that you wanted?
I wanted to be able to live without having to scrape and scratch for money, you know. I wanted to have the things that I wanted to have without having to just be working just to pay a bill. A BMW, I got that. I just wanted to live life. I wanted to live a good life in every aspect, just like any other human being that's living. They want to be able to take care of their families or whatever, you know. That's what I wanted.
And was it a party life for you, or was it a business approach?
Selling drugs is not a party life. It's a business, because you're actually a manager and an organizer, making deals, being in the right position. You're doing all the things it takes to become a successful drug dealer. A lot of people think that if a guy's selling drugs, you actually use them. No. The average person that sells drugs and they accumulate money, they don't really mess with them drugs. You might have a few guys that probably smoke drugs, or women, whoever's selling, you know, they may do it, but it's not a good idea because you can't make any money. It shadows your judgment. You want to be able to make the right decisions at the right time. Because as a drug dealer, I'm watching the people, the other drug dealers, and I'm watching the police the best way I can.
Did you finish high school?
No, at the time I didn't finish high school. No.
This was a full-time job, dealing.
Exactly.
How big did you get?
Well, I got big enough for the United States of America to lock me up.
The United States of America will lock you up for one rock in your pocket, so, I mean...
Oh, yeah, that's true. They got a lot of people in there that are actually crack addicts or whatever, and they lock them up. But no, I was at the level that I wanted to be on. I was running crack houses, selling drugs to other drug dealers.
And you'd be buying in what kind of volume?
Kilos of cocaine, and I would take it and weigh it up and put it into ounces and half ounces, and I'll make my money.
And back in the early 90s, what would a kilo of cocaine cost you?
$22,000. Depends on who you got it from, you know?
You told me earlier that your mother had tried to keep you on a straight path. She must have seen the direction you were going.
Oh, yeah, of course. All mothers, you know, they know when the children are lying. And she was that type of mother. She knew where my direction was going. She used to tell me, boy, you better stop what you're doing. You're going to go to jail. For a long time, you know. That always replays in your head when you're in a situation or you're in trouble. You know, the first thing you think about is your mom, you know. It replays in your head. It keeps going over and over and over again. You hear it when you don't want to hear it.
Was she saying to you, Sean, anything about not only this is illegal and it's going to wind you up in jail, but it's also a bad thing to do, to be selling crack to people?
Exactly. Yes.
And none of it penetrated? You didn't hear her when she was saying that?
No, talking to me was like talking to a brick wall. No.
I mean, because it's something I've always wondered about, whether someone who's moving a fair amount of drugs ever pauses and thinks, wow, there was that, you know, nice teenage guy I knew, and now he's all strung out on crack. But hey, what the heck, I'm making money and just keep... I mean, is there no guilt in it at all?
No, see, this is what people have to realize, and let me clarify this. No one puts a gun to a person's head and say, hey, I want you to smoke these drugs. The average person that gets high, snorts cocaine, or smokes crack, it's because they want to. They try the drug and they get addicted. It's no different than cigarettes.
So what's your attitude? If I don't sell it to him, somebody else will?
I wouldn't say that. My attitude is that I've done nothing to make them come to the conclusion that I'm saying, hey, you better take this drug or else.
Yeah.
My attitude is that, you know, I'm just... selling a drug. I mean, I don't solicit to sell it. It sells itself.
By the time that Sean Hudson was 20, he was making a lot of money, running three different crack houses. But along with that, he says, was his own understanding that it wouldn't last for a very long time.
I figured that, you know, I'll get locked up or killed one day or something. Because that's the mentality that you have, you know, because you don't care because you focus on this money, you know, and that's what I was focused on, the money, you know. And you're taking the chance every day, so you can walk across the street and get hit by a car. That's the chance you're taking every day. Mm-hmm. So I took the chance of selling drugs to make money for myself. And I knew that it was going to come one day. I just knew it. I didn't know when. And it's just a chance that I took. I was selling drugs out of this drug house that I had. It was late at night, and the meg unit, they came in and they kicked in the house. You know, they use a Batarang. I'm pretty sure you've seen it on TV where they mm-hmm. use a Batarang to knock the door down, and that's what they use, the Batarang to knock the door down. And it was several other people in the house, you know. And so they apprehended them, and they apprehended me. They took all the things that were inside the house, you know. And it was not a thing of what, how you feeling, you know. Of course, when you see the police, you know, well, I'm going to jail. So, you know, I was mentally ready for that because I knew the circumstances of what I was doing.
What drugs did they find in the house?
Cocaine.
How much did they find?
Very little. They just found money. You know, of course, I was selling the drugs out of there, so I didn't have a lot left because I was selling a lot of drugs out of the house. So they basically found money.
How much money did they get?
That particular day that I remember, I'm probably about $1,000 or something, $1,500.
So not that much, really.
Nah, that was just that one night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about weapons, knives, guns, any of that in the house?
Oh, yeah. When they kicked in the house, they found a pistol in the basement of the house. Yeah.
And this was going to be put on you, right, because it was your house?
The house wasn't mine, but I was the subject of the investigation, so anything they found in the house, they was going to put on me.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It was really that first bust that was the beginning of the end for you.
Exactly.
Can we fast forward ahead to the time when you were in court, when you were waiting to hear your sentence? Can you tell me about that moment?
I knew the minute I seen those, I knew that I was doomed when it became a federal case anyway. And I seen how tall the ceilings are. You know, the federal court, the ceiling seemed like it never ends, you know? So I knew that I was doomed. But when the judge, when he said, you know, because they sentence you in months, they don't say the years. And he said 240 months. I'm trying to calculate that in my head, you know. And then when I finally got to the calculation, I'm like, wow, 20 years. And I was saying, you know, of course, okay, I broke the law, and I know I did what I did. But people get out quicker than me that have killed people. And I was saying, okay, there's something wrong with this picture. That was what was going on through my head. I was like, okay, I got 20 years for what? I remember, I don't know if you remember this, when the guy was fighting with the Taliban. And, you know, that's treason against the country. They gave him 20 years for fighting the Taliban. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. So I don't think I did anything up to the level of treason or nothing like that. So why would I get 20 years?
Who else was in the courtroom when that sentence was handed down? Was your mother there?
Yes, my grandmother, family members.
Do you remember looking over at them after the judge said 240 months?
I didn't look at anyone because I was so mad and trying to figure out why did I get 20 years? Okay, I understand that I had to do some time, but what and why would I get 20 years? At that point, I had shut down, you know. I was ready to just to get up out of there because I was real upset.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sean Hudson served 15 of his 20 years before he got his time reduced under the new sentencing guidelines. But he says that when he first got to prison back in 93, he started comparing notes with others who were in for dealing and possessing crack. And that's when he learned the details of the difference between laws covering crack and powder, cocaine.
It was talking about this 100-to-1 ratio that deals with the crack cocaine, which is, you know, they say crack, but cocaine is cocaine. It don't matter if you rock it up or snort it or whatever, it's still going to get you the same high. So if you got 5 grams, you put 100-to-1 on that 5 grams.
So 5 grams of crack gets you 5 years.
Exactly.
But how much powder cocaine does it take to get 5 years?
5 years? 1,000 grams. I can get 5 years for a little bitty small piece of crack, and you can have a whole 1,000 grams and get 5 years if it's powder.
I've read about this. This is being written about as a sentencing law that seemed to be really racist in that the crack sentence, the high crack sentence, just doesn't. It's not in any way equal to the sentence for cocaine. I mean, when you're in prison, how do you see it?
I've been to like 8 or 9 prisons. And throughout my incarceration, all you see are young blacks that are locked up under the crack law. And it's nothing but a racist law because that's why they made the law, for that reason, because I believe, you know, with all my heart, that why would you make a law to target a certain nationality of people? You have a lot of white males, female, etc., that snort cocaine, okay, and they know that. A lot of white people don't actually smoke crack.
Yeah.
Crack is found in the rural neighborhoods or the black neighborhoods, you know, and et cetera. Of course, you got some whites that smoke crack, but you got a majority of blacks that smoke the crack. And the lawmakers and the people that's trying to get in position of power, they understand this and they know this.
When they were sentencing you, they had you on one prior because they'd arrested you once when you were 17.
Exactly, from the 17-year-old.
They had you on possession of a weapon, right?
Right.
And how much?
And cocaine charges.
And how much crack did you have at that time?
I had more powder than I had crack. I had like, let's say, 68.24 grams of crack. That's nothing.
Yeah.
And I had a whole bunch of powder cocaine, key and a half. It's more than the 68 grams, 68.24 grams.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? But that 68.24 grams got me more time
than all that powder cocaine.
Exactly.
So if there'd been no crack found when they arrested you, but just that powder cocaine, what would your sentence have been instead of 20 years?
Oh, I probably would have got 8 years.
It must be something that people spend a lot of time talking about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. See, in 1995, they were supposed to change the crack law. The guys in prison, they were upset about it. So the prison started rioting about this law, trying to get the people to change it.
Did you join that riot?
No, I didn't actually join the riot. I was at the institution that was actively in the riot. And what happened was they told us to lock down. Our unit locked down, but it was another unit that didn't lock down, and that's when the riot started. So naturally, during the riot, everybody gets whooped on, no matter what, if you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, so they came in and they beat us down, you know, and we didn't do anything. We did what they told us to do, but everybody gets punished in the riot.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Sean Hudson says that he met a lot of people in prison who were in because of these laws. Some cases, he says, are completely unreasonable. Like the story he was told of the wife of a fellow inmate.
His wife, she was naive. She didn't know what he was doing at all. She didn't know anything what he was doing. They gave her 30 years on a conspiracy for crack cocaine. She's still in prison right now. 30 years, you know, because, you know, they say she was in the conspiracy with her husband.
She wasn't smoking. She wasn't selling. She just happened to be living in the house where it was happening.
Right? Yeah, you know, a conspiracy, see, you got to realize something, too. Like, say if it's me and you talking, and they snap some pictures, they can say, hey, if Sean's dealing drugs, sir, well, we got pictures of you, you know, you involved in this also.
Yeah, it doesn't take much.
It doesn't take much.
So let me ask you something else. Of all the young guys that you met in prison or in under the crack laws, what was the smallest amount of crack that someone was in there for?
5 to 6 grams.
How much is 5 to 6 grams?
It's a sugar pack. Oh. You know how you get a little sweet sugar pack?
Yeah.
They wasting taxpayers' money to lock up a person for 5 grams of crack.
And that person serving how many years, Sean?
Oh, 10 years. You know, with that 100-to-1 and with your record, you might have 12, 10. I know a guy got 50 years for some crack. 50 years for some crack cocaine. You got to be crazy.
I want to ask you something about that, though, and you need to help me try to make sense of this. I don't understand why someone would get 5 years for a tiny little bit of crack like that. But I want to talk about your case for a minute here. You actually became kind of a big cheese. You were dealing drugs to other drug dealers. You were moving a lot of drugs. So when people look at your case, should they be a little harsher on you? Like, maybe this guy deserved some of the time that he got. He was dealing to dealers. He's not just, you know, he wasn't just some poor kid who was caught with a rock in his pocket at the pool hall. You know what I mean?
Put it this way. The law is the law. Mm-hmm. Okay. You got tons of cocaine coming over here right now. Trillions of tons. I wasn't a drug lord or anything like that. I just, you know, was selling drugs and making a little money. I'm a small fry. I'm nothing.
Yeah.
So, no, yeah, they should feel sympathetic for that reason, because I didn't deserve no 20 years. I did not deserve no 20 years because I'd never killed anybody. Anytime a guy can go out and you had a Ram football player, he runs a lady over, run up on the sidewalk and kill her. They gave him community service. Community service. I ain't never did that.
Sean, how much time do you think you should have gotten?
I mean, of course. I mean, I'm not saying I shouldn't have gotten any time.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering what you think would be fair, like a year or two or five? What's...
No. Because I had priors. I said maybe I could have gotten 7, 8 years or something.
Yeah.
You know? I know once you break the law that you have to go to prison or whatever. You know, if you break the law is the law. But if you're going to have the law, make the law right.
Sean Hudson says he's happy to be out of jail, though he still believes he had years taken away that he didn't deserve to lose. His next task is leaving that anger behind him and settling into a new life, starting an adult life at the age of 35. I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. My guest today is Sean Hudson. He's one of the many men who has recently had a sentence for a drug crime reduced. The new sentencing guidelines took effect last month, and since then over 3,000 men and women locked up under the so-called crack laws have been released. Now, all of them will have to start over now. In Sean's case, it means getting to know a 16-year-old daughter who was born after his arrest.
It was devastating because I knew that I wouldn't be able to be there with her, you know, as she was, you know, infant and et cetera.
Did you know, was this a girlfriend? Did you know that the woman was pregnant?
Yeah, I knew she was pregnant. But, of course, when you're young, you know, you're like, okay, yeah, whatever, you know. I really didn't start thinking about it until actually I started to get older, because as you get older, you get become more wiser, you know.
And at this point, was the woman allowing you contact with the little girl, or how would that work?
I seen my daughter one time in 1993. That's when she was a little bitty small baby. And I didn't see my daughter again until I got out just recently.
Was there any contact? Could you write to her? Talk to her on the phone?
Yeah, I wrote to her. You know, I wrote to her grandmother's house, and I was just letting her know, you know, hey, I'm your father, and this was going on with me.
Did you hear back from her?
No, I never really heard back from her, you know. But her grandmother would say that she would get the letter or whatever, and her grandmother made sure that she knew who I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew that gave me something to really get out for, you know. That made me want to come home, you know.
Yeah.
Because if you got something that you love, it keeps you strong while you're in prison, and it makes you want to get out to get to that.
Once it seemed certain that such mandatory sentences would be reduced, Sean Hudson applied for early release. Janet Hinton, a federal defender in St. Louis, was working on his case.
I didn't think that it was going to happen because they'd been talking about it for over a decade. And I was saying, well, you know, hey, they've been saying it. They've been saying this. They've been saying that. Oh, well, I didn't actually think it was going to happen, to be honest with you.
When did it start to look real to you?
Once I seen a guy actually leave prison. And when you're in prison until a guy actually walks out the door, you don't believe nothing. You don't believe nothing you hear until you see a person actually walk out the door. And once I seen a person actually walk out the door, then I say, okay, well, this thing is real.
And when did you get the word that you might be getting out early?
Well, actually, once they filed the motion is still up under the judge's discretion. The judge doesn't have to do anything.
Right.
Let's get this clear. The judge can deny it. And by it being at his discretion, I didn't actually think that the judge would do it. You know, so discretion is a big word. So, you know, it depends on how he felt that day. So actually I was like, okay, well, it might happen, it might not happen. So I was waiting and sweating bullets, waiting to see what was actually going to happen. And then I called Mrs. Hinton. And she told me that my motion had been granted, and she told me she'll send me a copy of my motion in the mail, and I received it. That's when I knew that, hey, it's going to really happen for me.
And how much longer did you have to stay inside before you actually were allowed to leave?
Well, they gave me immediate release, you know. Now, let's bear in mind now, okay, because let's not get it misunderstood.
Yeah.
I've been gone 15 years. I was going to get out in 2010, but I would have went home in 2009 with the halfway house. So don't make the public think that, hey, well, you know, I've done over half the time. I did 15 years. On 20 years, you do 17 years. So I was almost at the door anyway. So it's not like, you know, hey, well, you know, they really did such a great big thing. Okay, you know, they did a thing. They let me out a little bit earlier. But I'd already done the time. So really, it's a great thing that happened because it's going to help a lot of people. But at the same time, it's a slap in the face because they should have been did this years ago. So I can never get the 15 years back that was took out of my life for some crack cocaine, 100-1. I can't never get that back, you know. Of course, I'm happy to be home, but at the same time, I can't never forget what happened to me because of this law.
Yeah, you sound angry.
Of course I'm angry. You'll be angry too, you know. So let's not get it misunderstood. Ain't no jolly, jolly, hey, 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 that's going on.
I want to ask you about something, if I can, Chant. The number one lawmaker in the country is the Attorney General, a fellow by the name of Michael Mukasey.
Yeah.
I think you know his name. He has been arguing against this.
Letting out dangerous criminals.
I'm going to read you a quote.
I've seen it.
He says, many of these offenders are among the most serious and violent offenders in the federal system, and their early release at a time when violent crime is rising in some communities will produce tragic but predictable results.
Oh, that was such a great... He should have won an Oscar for that presentation that he just said, because that's all baloney. The guys, let me explain something to you. Of course, you've never been to prison. I don't know if you know people that's been in prison, but let me tell you something. I was in a federal prison camp. You know what a camp is?
Yeah.
A camp is out custody. We go out and we drive trucks around the outside area. There's no security. We go out to work and et cetera. It's an open area, and we're right by the community. Now, bear in mind the statement that he said that these dangerous criminals, the average person that you have at a camp is a drug dealer. The average person that's at a camp is a drug dealer. Of course, you got your white-collar crime, but majority of the people are drug dealers. Why would you allow these people to be at a camp if they're so dangerous? If they were dangerous, they couldn't come to no camp. Because you're right by the community.
So the whole thing is just nonsense.
The whole thing is nonsense.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Sean Hudson is now home in St. Louis, trying to get started all over again.
I've got a job. My life is looking great. I'm doing fantastic. You know, right now I'm be working as a houseman at a hotel, and I'm be cleaning rooms, etc. You know, whatever needs to be done.
Were they pretty good to you when they found out that you'd come out of prison?
Yeah, they sent Martha Stewart to prison. Of course, she wasn't supposed to go to prison, but does that make her a bad person or criminal? No.
No, but I've just heard stories from people who say that when they do come out of prison, it's hard to find a job.
It's hard if you just give up. See, I'm the type of person that if I can survive doing a 20-year sentence or whatever, there's nothing that I can't achieve in America. Of course, we got a great country, you know.
How much are they going to pay you at the hotel, Sean?
I have no idea right now. I haven't found all of that out yet.
I mean, the reason I'm asking is, for me, it's a way of understanding how far you've come. You were telling me a while ago that when you were a kid and you weren't thinking things through, you wanted fancy cars and you wanted to get them quickly, and so you gave up on a real job in order to to deal drugs.
See,
and so what will happen now when somebody pulls up with a Mercedes at the hotel? How do you... You look at that and you think to yourself, not being tempted this time.
Okay, well, now, let's bear in mind of this, right? Even yourself, when you was a child, you thought as a child, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And when you were in your teenage years, you probably did some things you weren't supposed to do. So as you matured, same way, I'm the same way. As I matured, I started thinking differently. See, let's not separate ourselves from being a human being. I'm no different from you. You just never got in trouble. You just never got locked up.
Or I just never got caught.
You just never got caught. I'm no different from anybody that is living and existing. I'm just the one that got caught and you can see me now. That's it. So you can't say them people. In the federal system, you got judges, doctors, lawyers. Before I left, I was talking to a brain surgeon that was in prison. You know, these are people that, you know, this guy never been locked up.
So how have you changed?
I've changed mentally. Once you change mentally, your whole outlook is different. I understand what's important and what's not important. I understand the value of family. I understand that material things are nothing because you can't take it with you once you pass form. I understand all of these things now, you know.
Hey, there's something else that I want to ask you.
Yeah.
When was the first time you saw your daughter?
Oh, the first time I seen my daughter was when I got out. I seen her April the 4th.
And she's how old now?
16.
Driving a car?
Yes.
Has she grown up?
Yeah. You know, I was terrified. I was like, whoa. You know how it is. You don't never think, you know, your kid or whatever can drive. So I'm like, girl, you sure you can drive? I'm like, Daddy, get in the car. I'm like, no. Hey, don't get on the highway now, you know? But it was hilarious.
How does she look?
She's a nice young lady. She's tall, you know, because I'm tall, long legs, you know. I'm glad I'm home now. I'll be able to chase the little guys off, you know.
And how is she taking to you? Is she accepting you as dad? Is she just...
Oh, yeah.
What's your daughter's name?
Shanice.
When you talk with your daughter now, is there any kind of hesitation in her? Like, let's take this slow, Dad. We don't know each other. Or is she starting ready to start all over?
We can't really start all over because you can't get back that time that you missed. You just go from that day.
Just pick it up.
You know?
Just start
just
off.
Pick it up. Yeah. Just pick it up.
And how is that? Is that okay?
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. It's great. It's magnificent. You know? It's magnificent. I'm not moping around and feeling sorry for myself. Man, I'm moving on with my life. You know, I don't have to look over my shoulder. I ain't breaking the law no more. I'll pull the police over myself. You know, hey, I'm not doing anything, you know, because I'm not into a life of crime. So I'm enjoying my life.
Sean Hudson joined me from a studio in St. Louis. If you have any thoughts about Sean's story or the undoing of some of the crack law sentencing that we're reading about right now, or perhaps you have a story of your own that you'd care to pass along, I'd like to hear from you. You can send me a note by going to our website, it's thestory.org, or just call in a message to 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. We're hearing an awful lot of news about politics these days. Proper thing. No matter how we look at the months ahead, some kind of change is coming. The one thing that gets tiresome for me is the endless chatter from pundits and analysts and experts and pollsters. I mean, while it's helpful to have people make sense of what's going on, after a while I just get tired of being told what to think. Now, I'd like to know if you have your own story. One of those moments when politics becomes personal. A time when politics or a politician surprised you or actually changed something in your life. You know me, I like it when the story is one of direct experience. Tom Linden has the kind of story I'm talking about. Back in the mid-70s, Tom was an admirer of the man who was then known for his fearless, trailblazing consumer advocacy, Ralph Nader. Well, Tom's now a professor of medical journalism, but back in the days of Nader's Raiders, Tom wasn't sure what he wanted to do.
I was in a really very difficult period for me in medical school at the time. 2 years of very intensive medical science courses in a really high-pressure institution, University of California, San Francisco, and I just didn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And I was really looking for some meaning in my life, and I had realized at that point that being a clinician wasn't one of them.
So what were you looking at?
Well, what I was looking at, and I talked about it with certainly my family, was joining Ralph Nader as one of his Nader's Raiders. And he was using doctors I believe medical students. And I thought, gee, I could really have an impact on society if I either left medical school or got my degree and then went right away to work in Washington for Ralph Nader.
And Nader's Raiders in the mid-1970s, they were very high-profile people. I mean, they were the leading edge of consumer affairs and environmentalism. And I don't know. I mean, it just they seemed to really have their finger on that sense of a public that was tired of being told what it had to buy and what it had to do.
Well, they were leading the forefront of regulation of government that were out of control, private companies that were injuring people's health and welfare. So this really appealed to me because this is just post-Watergate, post-Vietnam, and I'm very interested in socially what's happening in this country, and I feel like I'm in a cellar in medical school. And I had told that to my father, and it so happened. I was in my apartment in San Francisco, and the phone rings, and I pick it up, and the first thing I hear is, "Hi, is this Tom Linden? I'm Ralph Nader." And I go, "Yeah, sure, Wayne." Wayne was a friend of mine. "Wayne, this isn't real funny. You don't sound like Ralph Nader." He goes, no, I'm Ralph Nader. I met your father on an airplane, and he tells me that you're thinking of leaving medical school to come work for me. I don't think that's a good idea," he said. At that point, I realized it probably was Ralph Nader. It was so absurd. I mean, why would anybody call and say they're Ralph Nader? Because I had never made any contact with Ralph Nader. Only people I had told that to were maybe a few close friends and my parents.
So he said,
"Don't leave medical school. Get your degree and do your internship, and then you can apply for a job with me. I think that would be a good idea."
And you said what?
I said, well, I think I asked him why. And he said, "Well, you could do a lot more, have a lot more leverage if you're a physician working for me than a medical student who's taken a leave of absence." And I thought and said, "Well, okay, I'll think about it, Mr. Nader." And that was about the extent of the phone conversation.
That was it, you guys.
that was it. I was dumbfounded.
And so after you were off the phone with Ralph Nader, did you call your dad?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I called right away just to make sure that this wasn't a prank from somebody who was a really good voice imitator.
So what did you do?
Well, I thought about it. I mean, it really had an impact on me. I didn't leave medical school. I got my degree. I did an internship. And then I ended up doing a five-year residency in adult and child psychiatry.
All the while thinking, as soon as I get through this, I can go work for Ralph Nader? Or did that dream disappear somewhere along?
It disappeared. That dream pretty well got drummed out of me in my internship. It was such a difficult experience that a lot of my idealistic notions of dropping everything and working for Nader somehow left.
The story about Ralph Nader, I mean, the interesting thing about it is that it happened, Tom, in a world that was a whole lot less wired than the world that we're in right now. I mean, for some really important person to pick up the telephone and make a call is not like, "Here, I'll do it now on my cell phone." It was more like, "Okay, I got to sit down at my desk and take out this piece of paper that Mr. Linden gave me and look up the number of his son." I mean, that's kind of the cool part of the story in a way.
Yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal calling me. I mean, he was a busy man. He was a nationally known man, and he was calling a 26-year-old kid whom he never met. Didn't know my father from Adam until he met him on the airplane. But it tells me a lot about the man, that he really cared about me. Didn't know me, but he cared about me enough to make this telephone call that did have an impact on me. I didn't leave medical school, probably in large part because of Ralph Nader.
Tom Linden teaches medical journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So now your chance. If you have a story about a moment when politics gets personal for you, go to our website, thestory.org. Just leave me a short message. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.